Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, April 24th, 2014. And here are some of the headlines we're going to be looking at today. We're going to take a look at the politics. We're getting more and more into that lately now that the elections are coming around, the midterms are. We have a little bit about monetary policy and economics, but not a whole lot. But we're going to spend quite a bit of time on the NSA. We didn't get a chance to do that last week, and if I go more than 2 or 3 weeks without banging on the NSA, it kind of ruins me for life. So we had to touch on that. But let's start off with some of the political news that's out there. And Bill, you collect most of our story topics each week. You pulled together some rather disparate stories, shall we say, starting with a guy who's basically in a standoff with the federal government over land ownership and who got himself in trouble recently with basically trying to insert himself into the racial debate. Figure that one out.
Yeah, well, I just pulled out the main political news that was hitting the headlines, and of course there was this big standoff in Nevada with Clive Bundy, whose sheep were being herded up by the feds, and he was in this big dispute with Bureau of Land Management. And it seems to be correct that he's something of a racist, but that's kind of an incidental issue. He basically...
You think he's a racist, David, just a little bit? I mean, that was just... I had some sympathy for the guy before that.
Well, like I said, setting that aside, the issue was...
Well, you can't set it aside. When a guy comes out and does something like that, I mean, how stupid is that? Just from the perspective of looking out for his own side, you know? He's basically trying to marshal support for what he's doing, and he comes out with some stupid remark like that. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, he's not a PR guy. He's not a politician. He's just a rancher. You know, he's been up there with his cows for the past 2 decades, you know.
he gives a bad name to other ranchers. I bet you the other ranchers are kind of like, oh, God, just pretend he's not even there.
Well, I suspect it's going to be resolved not in his favor, and when it gets into court and that sort of thing, because he was doing. He consented to the BMI, which is the Bureau of Land Management rules and regulations in terms of grazing on federal lands, and he was fine with it until a couple of years ago they changed around the requirements, and they wanted to protect the desert turtles, so they imposed limits on the number of cattle that could graze per acre or whatever it was. And that put a big dent in Bundy's grazing land and probably threatened his profits. Who knows? So anyway, big showdown. All of the militia got out their rifles and guns and went to, you know, protect his cows from the federal bureaucrats. And it got down to the nitty-gritty, and somebody whispered into Obama's ear, Waco 2. And so I said, oh, well, you know, let's just calm down here, and, you know, we'll settle this peaceably. So somewhere along the way that some court will decide whether to put the guy in jail or, you know, seize his cattle.
We've had a lot of which we call, no, I don't want to call it ammunition. We've had a lot of reason to be upset with the president, basically since he was first inaugurated in 2009. But this is one case where he deserves kudos. I mean, this is a situation where you didn't actually have to push the guy to the wall and start a firefight, and they didn't. I think they actually deserve a pat on the back for that.
They didn't because there were so many, I don't know how many hundreds of people showed up from the militia group and the ranchers and Second Amendment people and so on and so forth.
I think the military could have taken them. I don't think that was the issue.
So anyway, the Bureau of Land Management didn't have enough guns or tanks or whatever they're supposed to have to do this. And so it's going to end up in court, and nobody's going to pay much attention to it, and it'll be resolved one way or the other. But certainly Obama's reaction was much better than Janet Reno's reaction. Blow them to smithereens, burn them down. They can't defy us. We have rules to enforce.
And speaking of racial issues, that crazy rancher wasn't the only one involved in racial issues, because there was a Supreme Court ruling that also involved racial preferences, and that has been kind of playing its way at the top of the what we call the top 50.
Yeah, no, it was the Supreme Court. It's the case is called Chouette, who is the Attorney General of Michigan. And they were trying to defend a Michigan initiative that said, under no circumstances will colleges discriminate on the basis of race, sex, blah, 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 blah. And they took them to court because they said, we need this affirmative action, and passing a constitutional amendment is a real pain in the butt because it makes it difficult to change. And so the Supreme Court came down with a 6-2 decision. It was specifically with regard to Michigan, saying that the initiative had to stand up because it was adopted by the voters and it was a constitutional amendment, and that's the way democracy works. Now, the context is that there are 7 other states that have similar bans on discrimination in favor or against racial groups. So it's not something that's really terribly novel. But I browsing through the arguments and so on, I concluded the reason why they lost by such a large margin, 6-2, was because the name of the group that had brought the lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
called the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, Integration, and Immigration Rights, and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. As soon as the justices read that, and they said, any means necessary, wait a second. You're not supposed to do that. We have democratic rules, and they followed the rules, and they adopted the constitutional amendment. So I think just the title of the group, which is, I guess, abbreviated down to BAM, something like that, is probably what doomed them from the start.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you've got to be a real diehard supporter in order to donate to that group. Imagine how long the check has to be in order to get that name building. You might have to pay 2 checks together to fit it.
Even if you just use a standard, what do they call it, the letters, with that long a title, it would be like almost a sentence in itself, a big jumble of letters.
The acronym, that's what you were looking for. Yeah, the acronym would be too long for the check. I mean,
the CTDAAIRAFFEBAMN.
EIEIO.
That's
good God.
But I think the Supreme Court made the right decision for the wrong reasons.
Well, that basically wouldn't surprise me at all. They do that a lot.
Well, there were 6 justices, upholding the constitutionality of the initiative, and they almost, broke into 6 different opinions about what the reason was that it was constitutional. But the bottom line for most of them was that, hey, it's an election, this is a democracy, they voted for it, and they have a right to vote for it, and that's all that matters. And so they didn't really address the issue of whether, affirmative action per se was good or bad. They just said, hey, voters decide.
I suppose that's a good thing, I hope.
Yeah, well, that's one way to decide. I mean, they could have very easily said, hey, the law says you can't discriminate. The 14th Amendment says you can't discriminate. How could it possibly be in conflict with the Constitution?
I mean, they don't care what's in conflict with the Constitution anymore. They ignore it with so many other things. So,
Yeah. Speaking
of constitutionality, the whole issue of net neutrality has reared its ugly head again, and most people don't think of this in terms of a constitutional issue. But even if you don't think of it that way, this whole notion of what they're proposing, what supposedly the FCC is proposing, is really quite scary when you think about it. Because essentially what they're saying is that if an ISP wants to charge different rates to different websites to be reached. That alone has some bad connotations to it, because who are they actually billing here? But you know, if you want to have preferential treatment to reach certain websites, you have to pay a fee. I mean, what is that? That sounds to me like what?
Free market capitalism?
No. That's free market capitalism the same way that J.P. Morgan was a capitalist. No, it's a form of theft. It's basically saying, you know, your money or your life if you want to be on the internet.
No, the FCC, I mean, they're the Federal Communications Commission, so it obviously has some relevance to free speech and so on and so forth. But they basically waffled. Because there are two sides of the issue. Either everybody gets equal access to everybody, or there's some division based upon the demand. So it's a supply-demand thing. And what a lot of companies, startup companies, want to do is they want to compete with Hulu and Netflix and all these other companies that are doing this video option selection routines over the internet. Well, that's a whole lot of data streaming through the internet, clogging it up, and having an impact upon everybody else that's just doing simple emails or simple web browsing.
Wait a minute. Hold on. Clogging it up? Do you have any idea how much freaking fiber there is out there? Do you have any idea how much a single cable of fiber can carry on it? That's absurd.
No, it's not absurd.
It is absurd. The bandwidth of a single cable of fiber is probably equal to the entire bandwidth of the NSA, for God's sake.
Well, you're saying the sites that stream video don't take up more of the bandwidth of the internet service providers than other users?
I'm saying that bandwidth is not that expensive a commodity, and not in short supply, such that if more and more people are streaming video, that all of a sudden it's going to just, you know, chew up all the available bandwidth. You won't be able to send emails. That's ridiculous.
No, I'm not saying you know, I won't be able to. But anyway, what the rule said was an internet service provider has to give access to anybody the user wants to access. I mean, there's no cutting people off or anything like that.
Right,
ISPs can do. All the ISPs can do is they can charge a fee for exceptional service to various providers. So it's if you have a provider that's doing peer-to-peer packeting, like for example a poker game, or a company that's doing high-density video, high-resolution, high-density video, and they want, to make sure that people get a quality experience, then they can pay for increased bandwidth. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Well, maybe you don't, but let me see if I can enlighten you a little bit.
Sure.
You're assuming, and this is a really long and, I would say, bad assumption, that the only way they're going to apply this principle, if you want to call it that, is in cases where there are huge amounts of bandwidth being used. But the way the law is written, they can choose it. They can choose to assign these extra beneficial ways of getting to beneficial amounts of bandwidth, beneficial amounts of access, any way they want to anyone, and charge accordingly. The law does not say you can only do this with high bandwidth users.
No, well, I mean, as with any bureaucratic regulation.
So essentially, the ISPs have just become the arbiters of what we can see and what we can't see based on, we're going to charge a little bit more for this one and not for that one because we approve of this one, but we don't approve of that one.
Well, here's the fudge factor in the FEC ruling. They can require a fee for special access, as long as it is done in a commercially reasonable manner, subject to review, of course, by the FCC, on a case-by-case basis.
Commercially reasonable is how much money can we extract? That's commercially reasonable.
Well, I mean, I think it is. If The only product the ISPs have is bandwidth. That's what they're selling, is how much data goes over the wires.
No, that's not true.
What else are they selling?
They're also selling access. And that's it's definitely the bigger thing. And it's the bigger question. Because essentially, it's not like you have tons of options wherever you live in terms of, you know, who you're going to hook up with. Usually, in most places around the country, if you have two options, you're doing great. If you're in an urban area, you probably have more. But for people in a rural area, I know people in a rural area, the only option they have would be like satellite. You know, so it's not like we're talking about a ubiquitous amount of options where you can just choose who you're going to go to in order to have access. That gives tremendous power to the ISPs. And you start giving them the ability to start picking and choosing which websites those people are going to be able to go to once they've gained this very limited access. That's a really dangerous precedent to set.
Well, but it's been part of the Internet market for at least a decade that you can get standard bandwidth, or you can get a higher bandwidth, and you pay an extra fee as a user.
Yeah, but it's not based on particular websites.
No, it's not, but it's still the amount of bandwidth that is allocated to you.
No, that's a critical difference, because that's basic. Now, before we were saying you can use the bandwidth any way you want. Now we're saying the ISPs can decide where you're going to use your bandwidth.
No. The FCC rules doesn't say that. Let's use Hulu as an example. Hulu is feeding high-density, high-resolution videos of movies to subscriber. Now, I can access, under these FCC rules, I can access Hulu. It's just that because I've only got 5 megabytes of bandwidth, I won't get a very good image because that's going to be less than what's necessary for that kind of high-resolution transmission. Now, if that's the case, which it is under, you know, current circumstances, and Hulu says, well, we want to be able to, you know, get priority in the transmission of our packets to this customer rather than Google or rather than Netflix or rather than somebody else. And we're willing to pay you ISPs, guys, to handle our packets first. Not, you know, only, not to the exclusion of anyone else, but just to give us a higher bandwidth access to your customers. So it is true, and this is a consequence of local and state government regulations. There's a number of options in terms of cable access, DSL or whatever.
Very, very limited options for most people.
Well, but it's limited because the government specifies it. And most cable companies are governed by city and county rules.
Well, I agree with that. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't create an extra monopoly situation for the ISPs, because it does. Clearly it does.
I don't see why, because I can still access Hulu with my 5 megabyte bandwidth, and I can still watch the videos, it's just that they pause occasionally.
Yeah, which means that the only way that you can compete is if you're one of the companies buying, which means you're basically giving whoever's got the most money gets to get access to the client. Those who don't have big money, they don't get to have access.
No, they still get access, just the quality of the access, bandwidth.
Oh, yeah, well, that doesn't matter.
So when I access Hulu, I get a video, and everything
you
is keen and dandy, but it pauses every 30 seconds.
Listen to me.
When I go to Netflix, it doesn't pause. Well, that's
because they pay. You honestly think it doesn't matter what the quality levels are? You think that actually is not going to influence the market in any way? Is that what you're really arguing?
No, I'm not. I'm saying it's valuable. That's
so
why the various
so
providers are willing to pay for it.
Yeah, which means basically the Internet goes to the highest bidder rather than being able to provide equal access to everybody. And there's a differentiation right there.
No.
We've already seen it. We've already seen it with social media and search. I'm against Google or against Facebook, but let's be perfectly honest. They have been able to use the structure of a combination of copyright law and, well, to be perfectly honest, the way the ISPs are structured and everything else, to give themselves
the ability to control access to a large proportion of the population. Now, they also have products that have drawn those users in, and certainly that helps a lot. But we're talking about something where these guys are basically able to dominate a marketplace. Whether or not that domination is good or not, that's a debate perhaps for another day. But there's little doubt that Google is dominating the search market. There's little doubt that Facebook is dominating.
Because everybody likes it. You don't want to mess with Bing or whatever else.
And that's fine so long as the opportunity exists for somebody else, an upstart, to come along and knock them down.
Well, they can if they provide a better service.
But the moment that you take away the ability to deliver quality of service, you take away the ability to shoot down the big guy.
Well,
it's the same kind of thing as what we have in Congress. In Congress, you basically have parties that have shaped and shifted the way the districts are set up, and then shaped and shifted the way that the election laws are set up so that you can't kick an incumbent out without having a massively huge campaign to do so. It's all totally written in favor of the incumbent. It's the same approach. It's the same idea. Make it impossible for an upstart to come in. Well, it's the same thing that's going to happen here on the Internet. It's the same thing.
No, I don't agree. But let's do a different analogy. Let's talk about grocery stores. There's a Vons three blocks from me, and in order to go to Ralph's, I've got to go 15 miles through a Ralph's store. Now, are you saying that Vons has a monopoly, or because Vons is there, Ralph's doesn't want to build in the same plaza? It's a demand response to the consumer demand. And if the consumer demand is for Hulu because they have a higher quality or a better selection or 100 other issues, then people should be able to go to Vons because it's only three blocks away instead of having to drive to Ralph's.
But at least the upstart can build another store at another location in the same area where the winner is doing well.
Fresh and Tasty can come in and set up their little operation right next to the Vons store if they want to.
But
it's going to be the consumer that decides.
The same thing cannot be said about a situation where you can buy off the marketplace by basically controlling the quality level. So that
Vons bought off the marketplace by being the first in line to get a slot in this strip mall three blocks from me. Just like Hulu probably has the money to buy bandwidth,
they didn't have any exclusive access in that strip mall.
No, and Hulu doesn't either.
They effectively do, though.
Effectively, they have the prospect of being able to serve their customers better. Now, it might be that there's maybe Netflix has a much broader selection, tens of thousands of titles.
They don't actually have to earn it anymore. All they have to do is maintain the large capitalized monopoly. That's it.
No, I don't think that's...
Wait a second.
You're supposed to agree with me.
All right, well, let's see if we can find something else to agree with.
All right.
Tax Freedom Day, we could probably agree on that one.
Yes.
Okay.
For people who don't know, Tax Freedom Day is the day that the amount of taxes the American people pay has covered all of the government expenses, and it falls behind a couple of days every year. So this year, Tax Freedom Day, in other words, when you've worked long enough to pay all the taxes that are due to you, falls 111 days into 2014, which is actually April 21st, which was last Monday. So everybody has worked enough now to pay for the government stuff, now they can start paying for their own stuff.
I always thought it was a really weird concept, because what it kind of suggests is that you didn't actually get any money to spend on your own for the first 4 months of the year.
No, it's just a weird way to look at it, that's all.
Yeah. I think the whole point is to help people understand that the government's taking huge chunks of their money. But you know what? I don't think that secret is hidden anymore. I think the secret's out.
They collect a lot of taxes.
They take it from the people who are the average taxpayer.
Yes.
Yeah, and they take it in large. And for those taxpayers who are still in doubt about it, they're about to find out in a year or so when all of a sudden they get hit with this huge tax for having bought subsidized health insurance. Oh, sorry, we're not there yet.
Not there. All this is just a way of visualizing it. If you look at his calendar, like a, 12 hours on a clock, the clock has to get to the 25-minute mark before you're making any money for yourself. Now, theoretically, if it goes up to, the 6 o'clock hour or, July 1st is the tax freedom day, then the government is spending half your money. So it's just a visualization.
No, I'm really depressed. Just keep going on.
Of course, in the Soviet Union and China, it was like at 9 p.m. or, November 1st, where you started being able to spend your own money.
Now, you listed another article here, and I have to say, I honestly don't know why you listed it. So I'm going to let you introduce this article about the Export-Import Bank. What on earth is this all about?
Well, the Export-Import Bank is supposed to facilitate imports and exports. In other words, they subsidize businesses that want to import things from China, let's say, and they give them a big loan, $1 billion, whatever, low interest rates, so they can import it. Another company, let's say Caterpillar in the United States, wants to export all kinds of tractors and bulldozers and stuff like that, so the Export-Import Bank gives them a loan, $1 billion, whatever it is, in order to facilitate their export of those products. So it goes both ways. But what the article was about was an interesting analysis that demonstrates one aspect of corporatism, and that is that the entire function of the Ex-Im Bank, practically speaking, is to coax foreign companies to buy Boeing airplanes. Okay, this bank that's loaning out money is basically loaning most of its money to Boeing. And it's subsidizing the export of U.S. airlines to other countries.
Okay, I certainly accept that premise. I just don't see where there's anything new here.
Oh, well, it's not new. It was just a particular study of who was getting these loans. And they discovered that it was like, 60% of the money that was being loaned went to Boeing.
So, in other words, they did this massive study to find out that major corporations are the ones who benefit most from credit expansion.
It was interesting. It was a particular corporation.
Aha. Uh-huh. So now we're going to start singling them out, because it isn't the problem of the credit expansion. It's the problem of particular corporations.
Oh, well, yeah, no.
I mean, you can see why I'm saying, I don't understand why we brought this one up. It doesn't make any sense
to
me.
It just identified one particular corporation that is benefiting almost exclusively from one particular bureaucracy that is another monetary intervention in the normal economy.
All right. Well, okay. Well, I'll give you points for that one.
All right, I get points. How many points do I get?
Brownie points, as many as you want. Hey, listen, we're about halfway through. We should take a break, and then after the break, let's pick up on the NSA, because we haven't talked about them for a while. And besides, they got to be recording us, and they got to have something to talk about,
There you go.
Okay. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Okay, we're back here on Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And, Bill, I just made a note to myself. We got to get a new promo done. It still says we're on at 6 o'clock. We're on at 7.
Well, people will wait.
Oh, they will.
Yeah, they'll tune in at 6 o'clock, and they'll say, wait, where is Freedom News Hour? And they'll just have to listen for an hour, and then they'll say, oh, there it is.
I give you credit for having a lot of faith in our listeners.
All of our listeners are faithful.
I think that's very good. Of course, they also have to be mind readers to find it. Speaking of mind readers, the NSA is actually trying to develop mind reading, but they haven't got that far, so they're sticking with, reading emails and checking phone logs and so forth. However, they are continuing to deny that they've exploited Heartbleed. I think that's fascinating. Why would you continue to deny it?
The only thing I can figure out is that somebody upstairs realized it was better to admit they were so dumb and stupid they didn't even recognize it was there, and say, "Well, we never used it. Not because we didn't want to, but because nobody told us about it. Otherwise, we would have taken advantage of it a long time ago."
Okay, yeah, but is there something wrong with the psychology of this whole thing? Because we know a number of things about the NSA now that have become very, very clear. First of all, the NSA always lies. Unless they're backed into a corner, they always lie. So we have to presume that this is all a lie, too. I mean, that's the only safe assumption to make.
Yeah, until Edward Snowden comes out with a document showing that they lied.
Exactly. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is that they lie for a living. They're very good at it most of the time. They're quite effective at it. They can actually convince a lot of people that their lies are true. And part of the way that they do that is by knowing when to lie and when to shut up. So why is it that all of a sudden they've not learned to shut up? That doesn't make any sense psychologically to me.
Well, they got a, a bad rap when the people leaked out that the NSA was responsible for Sucknet, which was another worm, bug, whatever, that they intentionally developed. I mean, in cooperation with Mossad and a couple other people, and planted it in Iran, and it spread all over the place into Turkey and Iran.
So you think this is a case of redirecting attention away from that?
Yeah, well, maybe we need to explain what Heartbleed is. I mean, people have read the news, but you see the name and it isn't immediately obvious, so I'll let you do that.
That's true. You want to go for it?
No, you can do it.
Okay.
You're the techie. You're the techie.
Essentially, I'll see if I can simplify it, which is always hard to do with tech stuff. But essentially, there's nothing actually wrong with the encrypted stuff itself with the Heartbleed bug. The problem is in the code that interprets it and basically does things like allow you to log into something with a username and password using that technology. How do you describe this? When a program runs on a computer, it runs separately from any encryption that's going on. It runs in its own little space. And that little space is where the vulnerability was. It wasn't in the encrypted code. It was in the little piece of program that was running. That made it a particularly bad vulnerability because you didn't have to worry about getting past the encryption. All you had to do was get up to the memory of the little piece of code, and bang, you knew everybody's password. That's a bad thing.
Well, yeah. However, this Heartbleed bug or whatever it was, related to the encryption code, was on servers. And so it wasn't that anybody individually could, get the Heartbleed virus or something like that. It's actually on the servers. But the thing that, in reading the tech details, the impression I got was that this particular bug was a time differential bug, so that all you got for free was about 60 seconds, and it was a random 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure that there was... I mean, there haven't been any documented cases where the Heartbleed virus actually resulted in any significant losses, with only one exception that I'm aware of, which was a Canadian bureaucracy that discovered that they had failed to update their software. And somebody came in and they, took something, and they're not sure what, but that's the only case, and there are no cases in, general public usage or server usage of anybody actually being documented as using the Heartbleed bug.
Well, that may be true, but it's also misleading. Just because we don't have any documentation of it being used doesn't mean it wasn't used, and you have to keep in mind, most cases where some hacker or, anonymous or somebody is able to break into a system, they can identify certain aspects of it. They know where they broke in at times. They can sometimes discern what data they got and so on and so forth. But a lot of the time, they don't actually know how they figured it out. All they know is they identify certain things that they attribute to, maybe they got in that way, so that must have been it. They never really know for sure how these guys got in. There have been a lot of break-ins lately, by lately, I mean over the last 5, 6, 7 years, into major databases, including credit card databases. Visa and MasterCard have gotten hit numerous times. And the fact that that happens so easily with companies, and I use the word easily advisedly, and, you know, obviously it's not easy. You have to be really good at it in order to do it. But nevertheless, these companies, these credit card companies, are supposedly in the business of protecting our credit cards so they can continue to make money on the transactions that take place. It's a big black eye for them whenever they get broken into. And yet, they get broken into by these little hacker outfits. I mean, we're not talking about major corporations breaking in. We're talking about, you know, a couple guys working in a basement somewhere. Well, how are they doing it? Sometimes they can figure it out. Sometimes they can't. I would not be at all surprised to find out that Heartbleed was one of the ways they managed to get in. And I can also see how it would be undetectable. Because if the code is exposed, how are you going to detect that somebody saw it?
But your attack, I mean, so you know that they've got literally, you know, bit by bit analysis capabilities and tools for everything that they stream out to the Internet. And so it just takes some packet analysis to figure out how they got in, because you can identify the source and so on and so forth. And that's basically the way that they identify
Just
Heartbeat.
Because you know the way they got in doesn't mean that you know how they were able to get at passwords.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how they identified the bug. Was somebody said, hey, the Heartbeat is off here. It's not beating at the right speed. And where are these packets coming from, and why aren't they going through the secure socket layer and all that kind of stuff? But what's commonly happened, the most recent one was Target. And that was kind of interesting, because what actually transpired was Target hired a company to control their heating and air conditioning units remotely. And so the components that they put into their computer system were the means that were allowed the hackers to get the information that was going through the credit card processing. So it was actually just a simple technical oversight that this heating and air conditioning company had, online real-time access to the technology of the Target Corporation, and that's how they got the data through the. Came in through the air duct.
And that's an example of what I was trying to allude to. I mean, I'm trying to talk in non-technical terms here, which is kind of tough on a subject like this. But essentially, there are uncountable ways to get it into so-called secure code. And we know this because hackers do it all the time. They do it in a wide variety of different ways, some of which are detected, a lot of which aren't detected. So, for instance, relying on the ability of a packet sniffer, which is what you were alluding to be able to detect whenever someone's breaking in, is a real long stretch of the imagination, because you have to know what packets you're looking for. And there are so many packets to look at. I mean, we're talking about numbers that are so large it would boggle the mind of Einstein.
Yeah, but there are search algorithms for abnormalities, and
There are search algorithms for abnormalities, but that doesn't mean they catch them all. To the contrary, they catch a small percentage of them.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that
we can't really rely on that.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that the number of incidents, whether it's Heartbleed or any other kind of virus or bug, is so small, so tiny. Over the past 10 years, there have been all kinds of incidents, but every incident that they encounter, Heartbleed or otherwise, they identified it, whether the packet sniffer or whatever it was, and they put up barriers so that there is some security. Now,
they try to put up barriers based on limited information.
Yeah, well.
And that's the key point. The information is limited, which means they don't have the whole story. So they patch what they can.
Yeah, well, it happened that I was a data processing manager back in the early years, and I was running a data processing system that serviced a couple of hundred users in a corporation that were handling credit card information. And all of a sudden, the system started degrading. It slowed down, and programs stopped working, and all kinds of weird stuff happened. And it took me about 3 hours to identify the cause, which was a, it's called a Jerusalem virus, that tags itself on to every file as it's being executed. And I was able, over the course of about one day, to get rid of it, number one, reinstall all the servers, number two, but also to determine how it got on the system. And what it came on was a little floppy disk, a little 5-inch floppy disk, where somebody had gotten a trial program from a vendor and put it in, ran it on their computer that was connected to the network. We had to send a nasty letter off to that particular vendor saying, hey, you got the Jerusalem virus you're spreading here with these little diskettes that you're sending out. And, of course, they had conniption fits. They couldn't believe it and went and checked and found out that was the case. So I've had a little experience in tracking down the cause. And you have to know a lot of technical details about how these various viruses attack.
Well, it also helps to have the small region to work with, too. I mean, you said you had a few hundred users you were serving. You were basically probably working with a relatively small, by today's standards, memory space. And so it became possible for you to track that down in a day and a half or whatever it was. You know, today, the amount of data we're talking about dwarfs that by I don't know how many factors. I mean, we're not talking like millions of times more. We're talking billions, trillions of times more amounts of data that is need to be processed in order to track that kind of thing down. It's gotten way beyond the point where one person can sit down with a sniffer and some basic tools and track something like that and be sure that you're going to get it. Add in the fact that, you know, the Jerusalem virus, it was named because it was another unusual version of a virus at a time when, you know, viruses were relatively small in numbers. Today, they come out with millions of viruses a year, millions and millions of them, far exceeding the number of viruses that came out when you and I were doing that, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. So, again, we're talking about a scale of stuff that makes it practically impossible to keep up with it all.
Well, but I'm saying it's been successful. The number of
well,
significant,
sure, there've been successes.
You know, the
and I'm saying we can't hang our hats on the successes because that leaves us open to the idea that, oh, well, we've had successes, therefore we're safe. And it's not true.
Well, yeah, I understand. I mean, it doesn't eliminate any of the risk. I'm saying the amount of risk has gone way down over the course of the last decade or two.
No, I would disagree with that strongly. The risk has actually increased.
Well,
the risk has definitely increased because it's coming from so many different sources compared
well,
to
the NSA is spending probably a couple of billion dollars trying to.
Well, they're probably setting them out themselves. They're probably the perpetrators of some of them.
Yeah, well, that was the other article I had the lead of this NSA section, and that was that according to a study that was done by somebody, where is the name of the. Anyway, somebody. It was called a. Verizon report from Data Breach Investigations showing that governments were responsible for 87% of online spying, which of course implies that they introduced a bug and, you know, tapped off the information. So according to Verizon, there were 511 spying incidents on internet transactions, and 87% were from state-affiliated actors, which meant governments. Rather than organized crime, somebody trying to get your credit card in order to rip you off. But the interesting aspect of this particular report was the way that they were doing it was phishing and focused phishing. They created a website.
Explain what phishing is.
Yeah. Phishing is when they put out bait that attracts people to go to a particular website. For example, do you have really clean teeth? You think so, but here's our solution. Click on the button, you go to their website, and in the process of going to their website, you authorize all kinds of things to happen to your computer. And so they can introduce all kinds of bugs and viruses and so on and so forth through the website. And that was what the Verizon says is the primary method of gaining initial access to computers.
And users have probably seen this too, because if they've ever gone to a website and their browser put up a message saying that it was being blocked because they detected that there was something hazardous, you know, some sort of a malware or some sort of an attack on a computer or something like that. That's what that was about.
Yeah, well, that's a feature that Google added on recently. If you do a Google search and you go to a website, and they've detected any kind of phishing activities. Phishing, of course, is spelled PH rather than starting with an F. So if you see the word phishing. And so now they are able to give you a warning saying this site has been reported for phishing and you don't want to go there unless you want to push this button and then your computer will die.
And Bing does the same thing, too. They've got their own anti-phishing program as well.
Yeah.
But once again, we have to keep in mind that despite the fact that Google and Bing and others, too, are making their best efforts to try to protect us from these things, like you were talking about, stuff still gets through. There's a lot of stuff that Google doesn't detect, and people don't realize that either. But you know, it's not like Google isn't trying. They're always trying to upgrade things and make things better so they can detect more and more of it. And they are getting better at detecting it. But
a lot of people don't notice, the Gmail or AOL or whoever has all these different algorithms and methods of detecting spam, and a good portion of the spam is phishing. Oh, here's a really great site. You got to visit this. Your friend Judy, with a link, and that's called phishing, and it's a link to whatever, Either it's a straight-up, commercial enterprise, or it's a phishing site that wants to get cookies on your machine so they can download executive files or whatever, and you click on them to find out what they're all about, and you're dead.
The ones that get me, I don't even know what they call them. There's so many different variations on these scams that, we run out of names to apply to them all, but there's one particular kind I'm seeing quite a bit of lately where... you're drawn in because somebody's offering you something free, some free software or something like that.
Yeah.
And so you go to download the software and you end up, unbeknownst to you, downloading a special downloader that they supplied to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that downloader also installs five other pieces of programs and it tells you in advance it's going to do it, once you download it, but it doesn't tell you that the download link you're clicking is actually going to include that. It just says, somewhere on this page there's a download link, and there's like 20 of them. And it turns out all of them have this.
And then, it goes to the installer, and there's five different programs, and they're all checked to install, and you've got to unclick them if you just want the main program.
Well, that's what I was leading up to. They've taken it a step further. Now they don't give you that option anymore with some of them. These are actually just installing it. The moment that you click... start your download program, it just runs the whole thing.
Yeah.
No options, you just bang, it's there. And it doesn't tell you that it's doing it. All it tells you at the end is, we finished doing your install. And the worst part is, this is like the icing on top, the worst part, based on what I've seen so far, and I check these out because I do online marketing for customers and so forth, so I get customers who ask me about various stuff. That's why I end up checking into it for them. And I've seen a number of these scammy type things where they're installing all this stuff, and when they're all done, they don't actually install the thing you thought you were going to install. They install everything but. I mean, now is that cool
free
or what?
It's free. It's free.
Yeah,
that's true.
The poor unsuspecting user is saying, why is my computer running so slow?
Yeah, right. Why am I getting these pop-ups all over the place?
Yeah, why are the pop-ups everywhere? Oh, geez. Your friendly NSA at work.
Yes, there you
go. Let's see. We've got about 7 minutes left. What else do we have about the NSA? We kind of been just, issuing some personal ad hominems against them, but what actual interesting stories do we have?
Interesting story, Googlers. Googlers are 30% better than the CIA. This is a program that somebody started up, I guess it was in the CIA, that said, if you want to help us out, we will give you scenarios, and you decide which scenario is true or what the outcome is going to be. Let's say, will we be bombing Syria before April 1st? And, this is the same kind of questions they give to their analysts.
Mm-hmm.
So they send this out to anybody who wants to volunteer, and it turns out that these housewives that get this question and just do Google searches and come to a conclusion about which, outcome is likely, come up 30% better than the CIA at predicting the outcome. Housewife Elaine Rich says predictions are reportedly 30% better than intelligence officers with actual access to classified information. In other words, these are people that do nothing but internet searches to get information on, let's say, Syria and what the status is and so on and so forth, and they come up with basically a guess. Well, 30% of the people involved, not 30%, there were 30 people involved. They did 30% better than the CIA did in terms of making those predictions.
So it does raise the question, is the CIA going to start outsourcing to the Philippines?
Well, I figured out, and I figure if we pay those 30 people like $100,000 a year to do all of our intelligence surveillance and analysis, then we could fire the CIA. So for $30 million instead of $30 billion, we get better intelligence without the bureaucracy.
We'll ask our friend Charles Faddis what he thinks about that.
Seriously,
we should ask him.
Charles is a CIA embed or whatever, who was on the show a while ago talking about all these various things that were being done by the intelligence community. But yeah, we can replace Charles. You know, he doesn't need to make, you know.
Well, we don't have to worry about replacing him. He's already retired, so I'm sure.
Oh, that's right.
Sure.
Oh, okay.
That.
So Charles is good. Wait, he's fine. He's retired. He's getting a big
but I
pension.
Idea.
The other thing is, you don't have pensions. You know, it's just a housewife. She's just diddling around on the web.
Well, that's what they're doing at the Pentagon. I mean, come on.
But these Googlers are doing 30% better than the Pentagon. So why bother with the $30 billion we're spending on the Pentagon?
Sure enough.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Glenn Greenwald, who we all know through the Snowden news, has been outside the United States. He actually lives in, I think, Venezuela. And he's been to Europe a few times and so on. But he was kind of reluctant to go to the United States because he wasn't sure whether or not the NSA or CIA were going to grab him, throw him in jail, and water torture him to find out what information Snowden had or what he was using it for. And so he finally got enough assurance from his lawyers so that he could actually travel to the United States and participate in a symposium and to accept his award called Polk Award for excellence in journalism. So he actually flew into New York City and was able to get back out again. Of course, Snowden can't do the same thing, but he got himself into a little trouble because he called into his annual Putin teleconference.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it asked a question. Are you guys snooping on everybody? Word to that effect. And Putin said, no, we're not. And, of course, he's talking in Russian.
Yeah.
No, we're not doing any of that stuff. We can't afford it. It's too complicated. We're not interested in even trying to do it.
And of course, he came from the intelligence community, so
right.
He's lying too.
Yeah, exactly. So Snowden was a little embarrassed that he'd given Putin an opening to deny everything.
It was
kind of amusing that he picked out that we can't afford it. It's one option.
Actually, I think the full quote was, we can't afford to go to the extent that the NSA does, but...
He's a politician, so mealy-mouth. You mentioned up front about facial recognition. We talked about license plate recognition was becoming a big hot thing,
right.
Not just for, commercial purposes, but for, FBI and CIA and NSA and all those guys.
Right.
So the FBI has publicly said, and normally this is something they would keep totally quiet. They wouldn't tell anybody about. But through Freedom of Information Act and a bunch of other sources, they discovered that the FBI is aiming to get at least 52 million people on their facial recognition database by scanning publicly available videos and cameras and that sort of stuff. So the FBI is trying to track everybody by facial recognition software. And the Electronic Freedom Foundation found out about it And the records they got reveal a plan to get almost 1 in 6 Americans into this facial recognition database by next year. That's their goal. 120 million faces already are in state databases, and despite the fact that the facial recognition doesn't work anything like what you see on Helix or Continuum, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's like 80% of our false positive results on the database.
The number caught my attention. Why 52 million? I mean, we have, what, 310 million people in the country. Now, some of those are children. They have 120 million in state databases. 52 million, that brings it to 172 million. Isn't there like a phase gap here?
No, I think it's just a data storage gap.
All they have to do is contact the NSA. They got lots of storage.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the NSA that's building this huge data storage center in Utah or whatever it is, which they're encountering a little bit of a problem because they're using like 10 million gallons of water every day as the projected demand for the data center in order to keep it cool. So they're getting flack from Utah, both for water and electrical drain on their systems that are all going to have to be upgraded. So maybe the NSA will just have to shut that whole thing down and forget about storing all of our internet and telephone data.
I think that they're just trying to figure out how to store memory in water. But that's another story for another day. Bill, we're out of time, but it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds useless. Who are people gonna rise up, get their share? People gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know?